Well, thank you very much. It's a great privilege to follow one of our great constitutional historians of Whitehall in particular, and also one of our great advocates and practitioners of industrial strategy. Indeed, Michael, the one thing that Michael glossed over was that I was at the time his junior minister when Michael was the Deputy Prime Minister, one of the first ministerial posts that I had, and it was a great pleasure and a privilege to work with him. What I'd like to do now briefly is to just take people through industrial strategy and something a bit different from it, which is science and research strategy. And you've heard from a proper sophisticated historian. Let's start with a very crude history of what I think is the shape of industrial strategy, which is we had, until the First World War, as was the culture of the gentleman scientist, and our universities did not do research. Germany was the home of the research-intensive university. That's why Germany was also the home of the Second Industrial Revolution, R&D-based research, closely linking the academic community and business. And America looked to Germany as the model, beginning with Johns Hopkins University, the first American research-intensive university explicitly based on the German model. And the moment of truth for us was the First World War. And particularly when America was neutral and Britain was lobbying for America to enter the war, and there were so many close ties between Britain and America, we thought it was obvious, until the penny dropped that all America's leading educators and universities were staffed by people who had gone to study in Germany. There had been no comparable opportunity for them to study in the UK, and there was a flurry of activity around this challenge from Germany. The doctorate, which had been created in Germany in the 19th century, was created in Britain in 1917 so that we had something to offer American students who hitherto could only get a doctorate in Europe by going to Germany. Nine of the 25 leading professors, heads of department at Harvard, had all been to Germany. The doctorate was created, and at the same time, rather ingeniously, the universities argued that if they were to deliver these services, they needed funding. So we had the progenitor, the origin of HEFCE, was created in 1918. The Department of Science and Industrial Research, the progenitor of the research councils, were created in 1918 in the Haldane Report. Committee of Vice Chancellors and Principals then became UUK, created in 1918. A flurry of institutional creativity, essentially trying to catch up with what Germany and the US were doing. And then for 50 years, and I take this from David Edgerton's excellent history, an incredibly close link between research and industrial policy, because Britain realised that to be a serious military and imperial power in the 20th century, it needed to have organised research effort, not unlike America's doctrine to this day. But the confidence in that model started to wane. I'm a trustee of the Science Museum, and the other week at our store, I saw a bit of the fuselage of a Comet aircraft. A bit of a fuselage with the window ripped off because of either there's a learned debate, was it poor quality riveting, was it that it was a square, not a circle, but we had catastrophic crashes of Comet aircraft which were investigated in this fantastic program, publicly invested in. We discovered there was a serious defect in the quality of the British product. Tony Benn came in 1964 when the Wilson government had been elected around the principle of the white heat of the technological revolution, and by 1970 thought we were spending too much on R&D of insufficient quality to justify the expenditure involved. So you then have a period when both parties are much more wary of this massive R&D-based industrial effort. The Concorde is another example. Obviously, Margaret Thatcher's scepticism played a role. But even under Labour, a lot of the research associations and organisations created after the war were closed down. And then, I would argue, a reconstruction. And you can date it to different times, but certainly Michael Heseltine was one of the crucial figures in the reconstruction. And successive governments, for most of the past 20 or 30 years, have practised industrial strategy in some form or other. and certainly Michael Heseltine did, certainly Peter Mandelson did. But, and this is the tension I want to investigate in my brief talk, in industrial strategy that was permanently frustrated by the tension between what ministers were trying to do on industrial strategy and the prior construction of a science and research strategy. This was very rarely articulated, but was based on the following propositions. First, an ambitious and so far successful strategy of maintaining research excellence across a whole range of disciplines. If you look at all the classic Elsevier cobwebs, whereas other medium-sized economies have got specific strengths, Britain has a peculiarly, amazingly wide range of areas where we score citation rates way above the average. To focus on rewarding research excellence, even at the expense of other objectives, like geographical distribution or indeed industrial relevance. It became the Nobel Prizes, the academic citations, the prestige of the universities, and it was above all, another crucial fact, a university-based policy. If you look at the distribution of publicly funded R&D in advanced Western countries, Britain is one of the outliers with an unusually high proportion based in our universities. So it's university-based. And incidentally, because of another peculiar feature of our education system, namely that students choose at the age of 16 to focus on a narrow range of subjects, choose between arts and sciences at the age of 16, which I regard as still one of the fundamental weaknesses of our education system, that meant they went to university to study the subjects that they had decided to specialise in at the age of 16. Robbins forecast a big surge in the number of people doing science and technology. It didn't happen. They turn up at university to study these subjects, which they've chosen at 16, and universities are staffed to teach them in the subjects they've chosen. And if you're a member of the university staff and want to get promotion, you have to do research. So the research activity of universities is in turn based on what the teachers are doing. So you end up with university-based research heavily influenced by the subject preferences of a bunch of 16-year-olds, which was never an intention, but is essentially what the system has delivered. And that particularly, and I personally welcome this, that's one of the reasons why humanities is a particularly strong area of research in the UK. It's because that's what a lot of 16-year-olds want to study. So that's what a lot of university academics are teaching. So that's what they then research. And also, it's a highly decentralized system. Trust-based, and on the argument that you don't, that with very high levels of institutional autonomy. Now, that has many strengths, but it had three crucial doctrines which made it very hard to reconcile that science strategy with the ambitions for an industrial strategy. The science strategy and the industrial strategy were in conflict for these three reasons. The way in which dual funding worked, what I call the Rothschild Doctrine, and the particular position of universities. And I'd like to touch on each one of those in turn, because if we want properly to link our research strategy in an industrial strategy, we have to tackle these three. First of all, dual funding. Now, dual funding has a satisfying kind of completeness about it. We pride ourselves on dual funding because we think other countries just have one funding stream. We've got two funding streams, and they are complementary to each other. And you essentially have Research Council funding, which is project-based and, of course, is not dependent on universities, but if you're looking around for people who are capable of doing it, you often find they're in universities. And then you have the hefty funding to universities through the REF, going right back to the great argument at the time of the war in Bruce Trescott's Red Brick, that our non-Oxbridge universities needed compensation for not having an endowment. If you think of this conceptually as what universities get instead of having an endowment, which was seen as one of the weaknesses of the bulk of our universities compared with Oxbridge and compared with the US. Now, you have these two flows, but what is immediately clear is what you don't have is a reliable flow of funding for institutions outside universities. So you have it's tough being the welding institute, the last survivor from the post-war creation of research associations, because you don't neatly slot into these categories to receive capital investment to grow. It's tough being the National Institute of Agricultural Botany. In fact, the only ones that survive tend to have prior and independent charitable status. It's a very fragile existence, and one of the reasons why I was keen to create the Catapult Institute, based very much on the Fraunhofer model and the excellent advice from Hermann Hauser, was we needed some framework where you could sustain and fund research establishments linking public and private sector outside universities. So the first thing is, there is actually, behind the dual funding model, there is a gap in the funding. The second issue is this, and I think Peter has already referred to the Rothschild report, which is crucial in shaping our model. And he wanted a customer-contractor model. And he argued in his great report, a very influential report, that the science budget should be for the blue skies, quote, pure research, which didn't have a customer-contractor model, but applied research should be funded on a customer-contractor model. And there was an obvious place to do it, which was departments. So some of the Research Council funding was cut to give to departments who would be the customers contracting to purchase research. But the departments in subsequent years proved to be appalling custodians of this responsibility. Whenever there was a budgetary pressure, they cut their budgets. So this parallel to the science budget languished, diminished over time. And then, it's fascinating to see particularly Margaret Thatcher's role in this. The person who received the original Haldane report in the 1970s was Margaret Thatcher as the Education and Science Minister. And she was an advocate of it. When she came back into office as Prime Minister, with Rothschild then as the head of the CPRS, she, in the absence of the department, said the obvious customer for applied research was the business sector. Businesses were to buy applied research, so the government had a role in pure research upstream, and businesses were the contractors, were the customers who would contract to purchase applied research. But that, again, leaves an enormous gap in the system because it's expecting business to take up a role which they are not willing to do. And this is not because somehow British businesses are unusually risk-averse, which is the conventional picture we always beat up on ourselves. Why don't we take risk? It's in other countries, public funding for research goes closer to market than it does in the UK. The disappearance of that second function that Rothschild identified left us with the valley of death. It is a result of a particular set of institutional arrangements not repeated in other countries. So again, you need to create intermediate institutions or intermediate funding arrangements that go closer to market than just funding pure research. And the final and I think most ingenious resolution of this was David Sainsbury proposing the creation of TSB, which then became Innovate UK, to which I think other departments, including the Treasury, had a rather ambivalent attitude, shown most recently in the very significant cuts in Innovate UK funding in 2015, when it was all supposed to go to a loan-based model. But essentially, it is plugging a gap left by that model in the Rothschild report. And there's a third obstacle to using a science and R&D strategy as alongside industrial strategy, which is universities are private sector bodies. Research institutes have been historically categorized as being in the public sector. And most countries have a proud network of research establishments. Think of what we associate with Germany, Max Planck Institutes, Fraunhofer Institutes. But not just Germany, the US, Argonne, Livermore. We should have had a network of public sector research establishments like that. But it proved, and I think this is a critique of successive government policies, it proved incredibly hard to sustain them. First of all, they were subject to public sector rules on recruitment, on how they should function, which meant that it always looked better for a research establishment, if it possibly could, to leave the public sector and go for the embrace of a university. That was the logical decision if you were engaged in a research activity head for the private sector, and you had the university as the umbrella body that would look after you. Now, subsequently, in 5 or 10 years, the vice chancellor might change. A university might well not regard itself as having a responsibility as the custodian of a nationwide research establishment, but at any one point in time, it looks like a very tempting get out. Departments themselves were relatively uninterested in this network that they had. The way in which DEFRA has handled its agricultural research establishments, I think, over decades, has been scandalous. And if we want to understand why British agricultural productivity has barely grown in the past 10 or 20 years, it's because of the failure of DEFRA to support institutions intermediate between pure research bodies and farmers that would convey best practice and develop advanced practices. But Department of Energy wasn't much better. The National Nuclear Lab shrunk and shrunk and shrunk until it just survived on getting funding for individual projects. No core capability once civil nuclear came back in. And something else, privatisation. And I participated in the early stages of privatisation in the Treasury at number 10. And I can't recall a meeting that I went to on privatisation when we said, what will happen to the R&D capabilities currently discharged by these nationalised industries? That's where a lot of the energy research or the water research was happening. And when we privatised, and again, I participate in these discussions, we didn't want a fat, lazy US capital cost model of regulating the privatised utilities. We went for an RPI minus X model, price competition, driving down the price, and wariness, active hostility to what we regarded as gold plating. And even when I, years later, was the science minister and you were talking to some of these privatised utilities about how perhaps they might do a bit more R&D, they would say the regulator won't let us. We're price regulated. They don't like us spending money on things like this. They regard it as gold plating. It is very hard work persuading them. So we lost more R&D capacity through privatisation. The research councils, who have heroically kept some of these institutions going, but nevertheless, they by and large think the dynamism and the research comes from having a perpetual competitive bidding process. So the model is no institution can assume it has any right to survive. And if you try to universities, however, do. If we said in 20 years' time, will there still be an Oxford, a Cambridge, a Durham, a Bristol, a Southampton, we'd say yes. You could not say that confidently about any UK research establishment outside, unless perhaps it was a charitable foundation with a very large funding base. That is a very different model of research than in almost any other advanced Western country. So that's why there has been, and we saw in Michael's powerful presentation, we got that sense of impatience. That's why the ambition of successive governments in the past 20 or 30 years to create an industrial strategy that included a focus on R&D has been very hard to deliver in practice. Now, let me end by just observing on kind of where we had got to and where I think we will head next. I mean, as Michael said, this fear about picking winners hangs over this debate, but in reality, governments all end up in some way taking these type of judgments. The purists say governments should only have horizontal policies that operate across the economy as a whole and not vertical policies that focus on specific places or sectors. But as soon as you try to live this in practice, it proves very hard to do. Your horizontal policy is to improve transport infrastructure. But where do you improve transport infrastructure and on what criteria? And if you put the Jubilee line in to enable the Canary Wharf to develop and the City of London to expand and don't build a railway line linking the east and west coasts in the north of England, there is implicit in that a set of judgments. So it's impossible to have a pure horizontal strategy. The only question is whether you're explicit about what you're trying to do with a vertical strategy, or whether it happens as a result of unquestioned and unchallenged and hidden assumptions. What we ended up in the coalition, and that's what I can speak about best, is I think, oddly enough, an industrial strategy that emerged out of four different approaches, each of which I think is an important element of any industrial strategy. And only to caricature it a bit, I would associate each with an individual. Vince Cabe, with whom it was a pleasure to work. Vince focused on sectors, aerospace, automotive, industrial sectors which are kind of self-organized, with which it's possible for a minister to have a conversation about how their industry is developing and what governments can do to support it. I had some sectors myself. I was very keen, for example, on education as a sector. If you look at how Britain is going to pay its way in the world in the 21st century, selling education services looks quite a good bet. And I'm disappointed there was no reference to education in the Green Paper, and I hope we will see education and some other sectors being recognised more. But you can have a business sector model, which is what Vince did. You can focus on places, and of course Michael was an eloquent advocate of that. I think he had an increasing influence on George Osborne, particularly look at the Northern Powerhouse agenda, and also Greg Clark, very focused on place. And that leads, and that has a powerful logic to it, which is if your investment is based on cost-benefit analysis that in turn is based on what you've got already, where people are already living, where commuters are already facing overcrowded trains, then essentially you have a responsive strategy which only invests in places that have already grown. How can you have a strategic view where you take a view on what could happen if you were to do something bold by investing in a place? And you can't do it everywhere, but I think both Greg with his city deals and also George with his agenda for the North were trying to rise to that. Then thirdly, there are challenges. We need to refresh this, but there is the excitement of tackling big challenges. And on this, I have to say, this is what number 10 added to the pot. David Cameron would be excited by the challenge of antimicrobial resistance, excited by the challenge of sequencing the genomes of 100,000 NHS patients. And he would, number 10's agenda was to bring these strategies to life by setting challenges. And then fourth, my focus was on technologies. And of course, there are criticisms of a focus on technologies. People say, oh, that's just a kind of technology push model of industrial strategy, and that's a risk. And also, there's always the risk of ministers falling for those shiny baubles that we all love announcing. That's why it's important that these be based on professional advice and have a coherence to them. One of the first tests I apply when people tell me they've got a set of particular technologies or missions they want to invest in is if I can remember the list because I can see what the conceptual framework is within it. And too many of these lists are random lists. You can't see a logic behind them. What we tried to do with the 8 great technologies is we first of all said it's digital, it's the dry IT-based technologies, which meant powerful infrastructure, it meant autonomous systems and robotics, it meant satellites as increasingly important collectors and transmitters of data. Then you say, and meanwhile, what makes Britain rather distinctive for a medium-sized economy is this is the home of genetic sequencing, this is the home of fantastic advances in life sciences, and this extraordinary coincidence or fundamental feature of the world that biological information we now know comes in digital form, in the form of genetic code. Where are the particular applications of this insight where Britain has both an intellectual lead and there is a business opportunity? And you find, for example, cell therapies, partly because of peculiar things like the fundamentalists in the US have made it very hard to have sustained public funding of cell therapies. You go around the labs in the US, they used to show me them. Every bit of equipment had to be labelled, whether it was federally funded or not federally funded, and if it was federally funded, you couldn't use it for cell therapy research. That is actually a massive, clunky obstacle to doing effective research in cell therapies. Synthetic biology, similarly, and agri-science. And then finally, energy storage, energy saving, batteries, and advanced materials, without which it's very hard to make progress in many other areas. So that we try to have a coherent form to them. They should be disruptive. And one of the other criticisms of industrial strategy is you can end up rewarding the incumbents because they turn up at the minister's office. What about the insurgents? And my view was that these technologies should be inherently disruptive. These should be technologies that any multinational is worried about in case they are the incubators of the next competitor that is going to displace them. So these should be disruptive technologies. They should be general-purpose technologies. So, in other words, you can't wholly predict which business sector will take them up. Now, we've now got fantastic opportunities. We have a Secretary of State, Greg Clark, who is personally very committed to industrial strategy, and a Prime Minister. Michael was absolutely right. To deliver this, you need ultimately the backing of the Prime Minister. We have in UKRI a body that could step up to the plate to resolve some of these fundamental obstacles that have stopped us hitherto linking R&D strategy and industrial strategy coherently. And so I am an optimist that faced with the challenges that Britain faces, we will now have a sustained attention to industrial strategy, and some of the assumptions on which we've worked in the past will be challenged and improved upon. Thank you very much indeed.